Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Tēnā koutou nau mai. Welcome to B-Side Stories on Wellington Access Radio. Ko Victoria Kwaidaho. Joining me today on B-Side Stories, which brings you interesting people doing interesting things in Wellington, is Rochelle Stewart-Allen. Kia ora, Rochelle.
Kia ora.
Now, Rochelle, you're a NGO coach. And let's start with that. What's an NGO coach? What does NGO stand for, and what does an NGO coach do?
Let's unpack it. So NGO means non-government organisation. It's a bit of a technical kind of term. We know lots of organisations, so we hear about things like charities, non-profit, for-purpose organisations. I like to just call them community groups. But it is quite a difficult way to actually explain things. So I prefer non-government organisations. We know what government is. We know what business is. NGOs are either formally registered organisations or more likely informal. In New Zealand, for example, we have about 115,000 non-profits, and only 25% of those are actually registered formal groups. Most of them are voluntary.
Say that again. Say those numbers again.
115,000 non-profits.
115,000.
Correct. And about 28,000 of those are registered charities. Some are incorporated societies, but it's really only a quarter of that are actually formally registered organisations. The majority of it is just place-based, local community groups just doing their things.
So what kind of thing count as a non-government organisation?
I mean, it's really broad, so it could be, lots of little organisations are the ones that I'm really excited about. So those little small kind of beach cleanup groups that might just have a Facebook group, it goes right through. NGOs will go through from little small groups that are working. It could be a parent group, it could be the toy library, something that's just locally based, right through to very, very large formal charities that we might know that have very large brands, things like World Vision, things like SPCA. So there's a huge spectrum.
But World Vision's an international organisation, isn't it?
It is. It's still a non-profit. It's still an NGO.
Okay, you mentioned non-profit. What's the difference between an NGO and a non-profit and a not-for-profit?
It's confusing, isn't it? They're pretty much the same term for the same thing. They just all have slightly different kind of things. So a lot of it just comes down to preference. So it's how people describe things. So people didn't like the idea necessarily, some organisations, of saying non-profit, as in you can't make a profit. So there is some, you know, a kind of movement of people wanting to say for purpose because they feel it's more about social impact. They prefer that term. There was a lot of discussion in my own head with myself about what to call my coaching practice, and I settled on NGO because it's a more common term. It sort of covers, it could also be, for example, a social enterprise, which has an element of profit in it, but could be considered a non-profit as well.
So, for example, the Sustainability Trust, mm-hmm. which does rubbish collection, and at Cuba Duper, one of their initiatives was the Feel Good, which was the, not recycling, the reusing crockery and cutlery and stuff for when you bought food. So that's
an NGO.
That's an NGO.
And it's actually a formal charity. So it's a registered organisation.
That's because it's a trust.
Correct.
All right.
You can be a charitable trust. Yes.
Okay. But you don't have to be a registered charity to be an NGO.
Correct. You don't have to have a formal structure. And in fact, I recommend that lots of people don't have a formal structure. That brings a whole lot of administration, a whole lot of things like board governance, a whole lot of infrastructure that requires a lot of energy that groups might not actually be that excited about. You know, mostly groups come together because they're meeting a local need.
So give me some examples of groups that really, you know, don't need to be registered.
So the beach cleanup, for an example, doesn't have to be a registered group. It can just have a Facebook page. Anyone can just start up a Facebook page and just set up something like that. It doesn't have to be registered. It doesn't need a formal infrastructure over the top. It's just actually a group of local people in an environment that want to come together, but in a more sort of formalised way, rather than you and your mates just saying, hey, we go and do this thing. Instead, it might be broader than that, but it's still in your local community that wants to come together. You don't need to have a board over that. You don't need to get funding for that. You know, you've got a free Facebook page. You can just run that yourself.
And what about organisations or NGOs that should be registered charities? Or why? What's the advantage in being a registered charity?
The number one reason why people tend to do it is because they want to have access to funding. So they see that as an essential step to be able to have a formal structure, which is actually not always true. So some funders require you to have a formal infrastructure and be formally registered, but more and more funders are starting to step outside that and say you could just be an informal community group and we would fund you.
Well, this sort of comes up to what you do, which is being an NGO coach, is sort of giving people this kind of information in Wellington. And so how did you get into being an NGO coach?
Well, I used to run a non-profit myself, so I've got a long history of doing that. For about 15 years, I ran firstly a fully voluntary, my own charity. And I had wanted to do that for a long time. I'd always been involved in other NGOs and was always really passionate about that. And then I then stepped into more of a formal role. So I stepped into full-time running non-profits, and I did that for another 7 years. And then I was feeling very, very tired at the end of that, very burnt out, and feeling like I was just a little bit of a kind of, a mouse on a wheel that was just going round and round. I felt like I just could not quite win. I could go to a bigger charity and with more funding, and maybe that might make my life easier. But instead, I started to really think, where was my passion? And my passion was actually for helping the new generations, people, leaders coming through in the non-profit sector. I was really mostly, you know, my passion is those new leaders in their 30s and 40s coming through and helping them actually do the amazing mahi that they do. That's what lights my fire.
It's interesting, the terminology. I mean, I am old enough to go back to really the 80s when I was very involved in several women's NGOs. And not that we would have called ourselves NGOs, we were collectives. And and we certainly wouldn't have used the language of leadership or boards or anything like that, partly as a reaction to the very formal organisations that dominated in the 50s, 60s, and were still pretty dominant in the 70s as well. It was in the 70s there was a real move away from the old Roberts rules of orders. Just to fill in people who might not remember Roberts rules of orders.
People still use them, by the way.
Tell us about Robert's Rules of Orders. I was going to give a quick explanation.
No, I'm really excited about how you're going to describe it.
Well, it was sort of like it was a code of behaviour at meetings. From what I understand, it was actually developed in the early 1900s, possibly even the late 1800s, to ensure that meetings proceeded in an orderly manner. And, of course, this was when you had a whole lot of community organisations or groups of people, interest groups coming together, forming unions, forming interest groups. I mean, New Zealand and women's suffrage was definitely one of those NGOs that made things happen in New Zealand. Anyway, Robert's Rules of Order originated in the United Kingdom, I think, and it set out procedures for how people should communicate in a meeting. But I am interested to hear that people are still using Robert's Rules of Orders.
It's very much about the motions and the seconding the motions. So it is not necessarily a formal structure that you have to have. You don't have to operate in that way. However, some organisations in their formalised rules or their constitutions do have that in there still. And if you have it in there, then you have to run it when you're running meetings. You have to include that kind of I raise a motion and then I second it and record that. But actually, if you don't have that in your rules, you actually don't need to do it. And it's, I think, a bit of a time-wasting thing. Like, essentially, either the board or the governors or whoever that group is who is managing the organisation, either they agree or they don't agree.
So why do people still adopt these fairly archaic rules of order?
And that's a very good point, Victoria, because there is currently no formalised training to either step into the nonprofit sector, to learn to be a manager, to learn to even be a nonprofit board. There is no compulsory or even pathway for people to enter into those spaces. It's a little bit different if you are in business, for example. You might go to the Institute of Directors and you would learn how to formally be a director of a business. But currently there is no formalised structure, so everyone is literally just repeating what they've seen before year after year in other organisations they've been to, other meetings they've been to.
Whether they suit their organisation or not.
Absolutely. And these are, this kind of systems change is a part that I find really, really interesting. And I love working with organisations wanting to actually shift how they're working and, be really set up in a way that works both now and in the future. And these kind of ideas that are very hierarchical and very bureaucratic and very old school, I think have served their time.
That's interesting, because I can see the usefulness of having a sort of like a code of behaviour, and in fact we often now, you go to a meeting and the first thing they do is after the health and safety telling you where the toilets are and what to do in an earthquake, they might say, oh, and we have a safe space over here, and a whole lot of new, well, which, because I'm slightly older from a slightly more robust generation, I often find a little fluffy. But I accept, that's the way people want to go. But then they seem to have the same sort of rigidity in their organisations. It's just not using the same language.
Correct. I think often it comes when you enter and you might be employed formally, or you come on board as a volunteer or as a board member into an NGO. You often, for example, might get minutes from a previous meeting, for example, and then those minutes can go back and back and back, and the replication of that process just becomes a normal thing. So there's a kind of culture forms in every organisation, and it's the people who have been there the longest tend to kind of direct that and are often resistant sometimes to the change that's required, and nobody kind of stops until they get permission or someone raises it to say, hey, we could actually do this in a better way or a way that suits us versus the way that we've traditionally done this all these years.
Well, I'd really like to talk a little bit more, or hear you talk a little bit more about different ways of doing things. Ko Victoria Kwe Taho, and I'm talking to Rochelle Stewart-Allen about non-government organisations and how they are managed, arranged, and ways that they can better do what it is they want to do. But I think we'll take a little break. And so both Rochelle and I like jazz. So the first track I'm going to play is from the Putumayo Women of Jazz. And it is Stacey Kent, Shall We Dance?
Shall we dance on a bright cloud of music? Shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Oh, perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance, with a clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen? Shall we dance? Shall we dance? Shall we dance? Say good night and mean goodbye. Oh, perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? Understanding that this kind of thing can happen. Shall we dance? Dance? Shall we dance?
And that's Stacey Kent from Putumayo Presents Women of Jazz. It's a wonderful little compilation album. I used to get my Women of Jazz CDs from Trade Aid, so I don't know where they are now. You could try one of the independent record shops in Cuba Street. But look out for them, because it's a way to get yourself introduced to a really wide variety of music. Now, you're listening to B-Side Stories on Wellington Access Radio, 106.1 FM, Ko Victoria Kwe Taho, and with me in the studio is Rochelle Stewart-Allen, an NGO coach, a non-government organization coach, someone who helps NGOs get their acts together if they feel like they need help getting their acts together. Because, of course, some organizations don't feel like they need any help. They feel like they're doing just fine as they are. Thank you very much. We've always done it this way. But it's very interesting. One of the things, Rochelle, you mentioned in the first part of the show is that there are over 115,000 non-government organisations in New Zealand. 28,000 of them are registered charities. And that's a lot of people doing a lot of things. Let's just sort of break down the kind of things that NGOs do. You mentioned that something like a beach cleanup group is an NGO. I know Nicole Miller, who I've talked to, is involved in citizen science and mapping Wellington's coastline. So what she does is an NGO. And, of course, Wellington Access Radio that you're listening to is an NGO. But what are – and then there are the bigger ones. Plunkett's an NGO. Changemakers Refugee Forum's an NGO. I'm trying to think of the other NGOs that have been in my life recently.
Voice of Araha.
Voice of Araha, which is one of the programs on Wellington Access Radio. Which is run by a very energetic team led by Codrin, and that's an NGO. So some of the program makers on Wellington Access Radio are NGO groups, some registered, I think, and many others not. But some NGOs are service providers. I'm thinking of Wellington City Mission and the Home of Compassion. I mean, they are providing essential services in Wellington.
Correct. There is essentially social service contracts from government. So government needs to deliver and take care of the people. That's a whole a separate conversation on itself. But they are not that they can't do that in-house. So instead they contract out into NGOs to deliver the frontline services. So that could be
in fact, that's quite a strong argument that the NGOs, because they are often community-based, are better at delivering services than some centralised government department.
Totally. I mean, when you've got communities that need very specialised expertise and help and assistance, then you need people who are trusted, who are able to come in and work alongside those people. So this is where NGOs start to step in and really excel. But the social service aspect of NGO sector is the largest funding because of these government service contracts that come out. But it's not always the largest in terms of numbers. So you have other groups, you've got theatres, you've got early childhood centres, you've got sports groups, you've got such a diverse group of NGOs every day influencing you, and you're intersecting and interacting with that society. So some of it is social service and health providers, for example, but not all of it. It can be quite surprising when you actually start to have a look at the list.
Sports clubs?
Sports clubs, yes.
Community initiatives, community sports initiatives or yes. clean up initiatives. We already talked about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's theatres. Some of those are non-profits. There are some of the universities. So there's schools. There's, it's just such a broad group of people, environmental groups that are working in there, for example, 350 Aotearoa. So you've got, and then you've got really huge charities like Greenpeace, for example, in the environment space. So my passion is definitely in that small to medium size groups. They're the ones that I'm most passionate about. I call them charity SMEs, as in small and medium enterprises. We have a business term for that, SMEs, but we don't have a non-profit
SMEs, size. SMEs, that's another one of those acronyms. So SMEs, small and medium
enterprises. So how I talk about it, I talk about the number of people that might be employed. So 1 to 5 is what I would call a small organisation. And then you can have, say, maybe 5 to 15 or 5 to 20 in terms of staff. Like once you're in that kind of space, I would still call that small to medium.
So when you say 1 to 5, you're talking about paid workers. Because,
correct.
Paid workers. But many of these NGOs, I'm thinking here of Wellington Access Radio, there's, I think, 4 or 5 paid workers, but there are many, many, many more unpaid workers in the people that make the programs.
Absolutely. I mean, volunteering is the backbone of our communities in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I mean, if you volunteer, you understand that, and a huge amount of people in New Zealand volunteer. You know, millions of people volunteer in New Zealand and provide something that they're usually passionate about in an area that they're passionate about. They might have lived experience in that area, or they have children, or they've, you know, intersected. For example, I do baking for Good Bitches Baking. So that is primarily made up of just volunteers all around the country just doing baking that then gets donated to other NGOs. So there are just so many volunteers, and it's, you know, really inspiring, I think, that people really feel that sense of community. And I think that, you know, in the world of, you know, doom scrolling and bad news everywhere, I think all you have to do is go into a local community and you'll see these little pockets of groups. You know, Marae is doing amazing things. Like, there's just little pockets of groups everywhere that are just doing their thing. You know, they're building community, they're building social cohesion, they're helping people locally, and they're being helped themselves.
Well, I want to come back to some of the language terminology, but I don't want to get caught up in it just yet. But one of the things that you've got a website called The NGO Coach, and I couldn't find it when I typed in The NGO Coach, but I did find it when I typed in your name, which is Rochelle Stewart Allen. And you have on that website the various sorts of things you do, like and some of the things you've written about, like strong boards and getting unstuck. So let's have a look at those two together. So how do NGOs get stuck? Where is the common places that they get stuck? And what do you mean about strong boards?
I think getting stuck is a little bit about what we've talked about already, where you're kind of just going through the motions of what you deliver. You might not have ever or even recently reviewed what your kind of vision is for the organisation, your core mission, whether you're actually achieving that. Have you talked to the people that you're serving? Are you actually meeting their needs? Because needs of communities change continually. We saw that during COVID. We saw it during the cyclones. You know, we saw it during the earthquakes. Needs of communities can literally change overnight. And you can't just keep doing the same thing year after year after year. You can if you've reviewed it, if you have checked with your communities, is this what you need? But life is changing all the time. So people get really stuck in this thinking of this is who we are and this is how we deliver. But actually, an organisation is not an organisation in itself. It's very much a group of broader people that includes your stakeholders, it includes the people that you're serving, it includes your funders. It might include government, it might include other similar organisations that are also working in the same areas as you. So you really need to be having those conversations, keeping your ear to the ground. You could do formal evaluations. Not all organisations have infrastructure for that. But just simply just, you know, getting a group of people around the table and say, let's have a chat about who we are, what we're about, what are people saying about us, are we actually doing what we should be doing and what's needed, and being really clear about that and really deliberate.
And how do you as an NGO coach sort of facilitate that process?
I mean, I offer training, but I also do very bespoke things for organisations because every organisation is quite different. It's made up of a different set of people. It has a different outcome that they're trying to achieve. They're always, I talk about it like a life cycle. So an organisation is going through, childhood and then adolescence and then adulthood. You would hope that they're shifting in and they're putting more infrastructure in. But I am really passionate about just getting alongside, hearing what their needs are, and then helping determine where I can help them the best. And with the idea that they will fly free after they've worked with me and they will go on and do something, you know, do the things that they've learned or they've readjusted or adapted. And they might come back at another time because suddenly they want to talk about something else or resolve something else or design something differently. But, you know, my idea is not to build that dependency.
Mm. Well, it's interesting when I was doing a bit of research for the show. I was looking up Hui'e, Community Aotearoa, and at a recent Hopori conference, their community conference, they had Roman Kuznarnik. I practiced saying this. I practiced pronouncing it properly. And now, of course, I've forgotten how to pronounce Krasnarik. I think that's closer to the correct pronunciation. Anyway, Roman Krasnarik is an Australian writer, social philosopher. And one of the things, he was a keynote speaker at this conference. And he talked about the tyranny of the now. That often community organisations are caught up in the now. We've got to do this. We've got to do this now. We've got a need. We've got an urgency. And we don't have time to sit around and revisit our mission or our policy, our procedures. And, because we've got this urgent now. So what's your thinking on that?
I mean, absolutely so many nonprofits or NGOs live in a reactive space. And this is primarily driven through resourcing. So there's a lot of complexity around that, but the funding space, whether it's government funding or philanthropic funding, essentially has driven this kind of scarcity mindset. And the needs of community are 24/7 and constantly growing. So you've got reduced funding and increased need. And so it's really easy to just have your head down. You're like that little, there used to be a cartoon years ago and it had a little hippopotamus looking like a human, but staring down a little rock on the ground and above him a huge grand piano was coming down about to squash him. And I feel like that is often what it's like when you're trying to run a nonprofit. It's really hard to carve yourself space to firstly care for yourself and secondly care for your organisation and take a little step back and look across an organisation and see some of those things that we've talked about. But you have to value that and understand about why that's a core part of running your organisation. If all you're doing is just buried in the weeds, then you're never going to find any space or time or resource for it.
Well, I liked the title of one of your resources, which was Burnout is Not a Badge of Honour. Because having experienced burnout as a paid worker at an NGO and burnout as a as an unpaid worker at an NGO, I really I thought that's speaking to me.
It is. Unfortunately, there is a kind of martyrdom in the sector because we're very, very driven by passion and by our passion for community, effectively. And so we tend to give over and above what is healthy or even possible. So I call it about this balance between community care and personal care. And what we tend to do is just give and give and give and give and give and give and give. Hence what you were discussing about leading to burnout. I've also been in burnout myself. And so you can't pour from an empty cup, right? You have to be filling yourself to be able to actually keep giving out.
And that's one of the things I think of a healthy NGO is that it has mechanisms that recognise the effort that everybody's putting in into the organisation, that the unpaid workers as well as the paid workers. Otherwise you get this weird sort of feeling of, you know, being unappreciated.
Totally. And that happens a lot, particularly in the voluntary space, because everyone's so busy. They don't necessarily have time or energy or even recognition that they need to be actively feeding and building up and thanking their volunteers as well.
Hmm. Well, we're going to come back for the last segment of the show, but I've got another track. This one is also from a compilation album. In fact, it's a compilation album I got in Australia many, many years ago from Triple J, which is part of the Australian Broadcasting Network now, but it originally started as a mix of paid workers and volunteers. But they did this compilation album of world music, one of after jazz and blues, another passion of mine. And this is from Zap Mama. The song is titled Black.
J'examine et je fulmine. Moi la carabine, ça me dit. Mais vous, je vous ai là. Ma poitrine, je m'incline. Je vous fais signe. Je vous dis. Coupone sa ma pendo, coupone sa ma pendo. Nani sa idea, nani sa idea. Na tu sa idea batata, batoto, batoto.
I wanna save it. Do it, I have to follow my way. Il faut sauver tout. Et je dis
brûle la 4-4-4 don. 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 Brûle la 4-4-4 don.
And that's the wonderful a cappella singing of Zap Mama and Burak, my favourite song of theirs. Zap Mama actually featured at a WOMA many years ago. I'm thinking my son was very young, so it's at least 10, 12 years ago. And they were a Belgian group of women who were all migrants from different parts of Africa. And they got together as a community group and supporting each other. They started singing and jamming, and somebody said, well, why don't we record it? And they became a hit. Now, I am talking to Rochelle Stewart-Allen on B-Side Stories here on Wellington Access Radio, 106.1 FM. And we're talking about non-government organisations, their organisation, their management and governance, and how Rochelle, in her role as a NGO coach, helps groups to be stronger. And so let's talk a bit about the back to the language, which I was interested in, which is the whole board thing. I mean, that's very formal language that I've seen come into the NGO sector, because they used to have committees or councils or organising groups. And then somewhere around 20, 25 years ago, they became boards. About 20 years ago, they became boards. And a lot more hard lines, it seemed sometimes, on who did what.
It's very much driven by the legislation, but also I think this idea, which we currently see happening as well in other sectors, in other areas, this idea that a business language can also be, you know, put over effectively nonprofits. So this idea of calling it boards and that transition from committees. So some organisations that have been around that time are still calling them committees. So there's no compulsory
or councils. Or
yeah, there's no compulsory language in how it is, how it's referred to. It's perfectly up to the organisation on what they might call that group, that effectively governing group. But boards has become, you know, a very common term in terms of how they might describe that at the moment.
Well, one of the other things that I've found or observed is that the changing demarcation of who does what in an organisation, and often a very sort of almost territorial coming from, oh, well, you can't do that, that's a board responsibility, which can be very frustrating for people involved in the operational side of an organisation. Or conversely, oh, you can't be, you can't do that, that's a management responsibility, from people who are involved in the governance side of things. And so how do you negotiate that minefield?
I mean, as an ex-manager myself, I really like a demarcation between governance and management. For some organisations it works, for others it doesn't. I mean, how I describe boards is there's two types of boards. So there's a governing board who works at the strategic level, maybe puts the strategic objectives or strategic plans together and is very hands-off and keeps a kind of overview, effectively setting the direction of the organisation forward and being accountable for that. Then there is what I call operational boards, which are more in that small organisation, you know, new organisations coming through where they might have a founder still in the organisation, either at management or board level, and you actually need the board members to be doing stuff within the organisation because you don't have enough employees or formal roles to be able to do that. But as organisations transition and mature and go from that kind of childhood through to adolescence, once they start to get a bit of income and they get a bit more infrastructure, then it is much more helpful, I think, to have a separation between governance and management. However, having said that, new organisations, there's new styles emerging of how community organisations work, and I think probably long term that's going to look slightly different, and it does in some of the newer organisations. There's a consensus model which I really like called sociocracy, which was put together to look at how you would pull in this space a group of people together to decide on consensus and reach a decision making. And I really like that because it's outside the hierarchical infrastructure that we think of, with a board at the top, a manager in the middle, and then the staff or the kaimahi or volunteers underneath that.
Which is not always appropriate in a community-based non-government organisation.
Totally, especially in informal ones. So if you're in a community organisation yourself, you'll know that just something gets done. So maybe there's a WhatsApp group and someone says, here's a need. Like, for example, during COVID, I knew a community organisation and they were like, someone needs to mow the lawn. This person needs their lawns mowed. So it goes out on the WhatsApp group and someone says, oh, I can do that tomorrow night. And then that gets done. Someone said, oh, we need some more telephone cards because we need to ring back home overseas. So people went round, people put a bit of money in, and someone went and purchased the cards and distributed them. So that sort of very informal model, I think, is we're going to see more of that going forward, even on formalised organisations.
Well, because it occurred to me we haven't touched on it, and we haven't touched on the internet, how that has changed how organisations work. So I'll have to get you back another time, Rochelle. But, you know, we are, of course, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and Māori decision-making, consensus decision-making, is quite different from some of the formal Pākehā board policies. Same with Pacifica communities. It's based on knowledge and knowing your community and being able to respond as when needed. And how do you think that is changing as people become more sensitive or aware of tikanga Māori custom, that our organisations are changing, or is it still just lip service?
Well, I think iwi are very interesting example, because they may have a Māori authority, they could have social enterprises, they might have charitable registered organisations, they might have businesses. So they might have all of that together under one umbrella. So I think that is absolutely influencing what's happening. I think going forward, we're seeing a lot more organisations wanting to be responsive to te tiriti o waitangi. So, and that way of working, that way of inclusivity, the way of consensus making, will naturally permeate and shift and change some of these structures that are currently in place.
Because at the same time as you have a very strong commitment to consensus in Māori communities, you also have a very strong understanding of roles and responsibilities and who is qualified to speak on certain things, which are often arrogant Pākehās think, oh, well, I can speak on anything.
I mean, totally. I mean, you get a huge amount of complexity, like any formal or informal structure. You've got different people with different ideas about how things work, and sometimes having that kind of formalised rules or adapting or adjusting your rules as you go forward, not just sitting on one set of kind of rules or formation of the organisation for 10 years or 20 years. You know, the world has pivoted in that time, like constantly going back to your core way of working. And one thing I really like working with organisations is around exactly what you're talking about, decision making. How do you ensure that people's voices are heard, not just the loudest person or the most dominant person?
Well, Rochelle, I'm definitely going to have to ask you back on the show again, because I feel like we've just scratched the surface of what we could talk about. I'm Victoria Quaid, and I've been talking to Rochelle Stewart-Allen about governance and management of NGOs and her work as an NGO coach. And thank you so much for joining us, because it's been a really, really fascinating discussion. We're going to go out with one more Women and Jazz. Good night.
Good night. Close your eyes and just sleep tight. Lie awake and watch you dream, to be sure what that all of your dreams are. happen. My dear, don't you worry about a thing. I'll be near to you all night and through the evening. I'll be by your side. So good night. Close your eyes and just sleep tight. I'll lie awake and watch you dream. To be sure that all of your dreams are your own.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.